Hello, I'm Chuck Weiss, and welcome to Close Encounters. Every week at this time, I'll act as your guide while together we explore the twin phenomena of UFOs and alien abduction. Last week, I lied. I said that this week we would talk about Hollywood's treatment of UFOs. That subject requires a little more preparation than I could give it this week, so we'll do that show at another time. Instead, we're going to learn about three high-profile cases of close encounters. When we come back, we'll talk about the 1961 abduction of Betty and Barney Hill.
What is Cop Watch? Cop Watch is a network of activist organizations in the United States and Canada that observe and document police activity while looking for signs of police misconduct and police brutality. Their database is a permanent searchable repository of complaints filed against police officers at copwatch.org. You can report an incident for permanent inclusion in their database at copwatch.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Muni Radio in San Francisco.
People with disabilities and other challenges often suffer from being labeled by their disability and are faced with prejudice. People may exclude them or make assumptions and judge people with disabilities without knowing the facts or getting to know the person. All people deserve respect. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Did you know that compact fluorescent light bulbs use 60% less energy than regular light bulbs? And that each one saves about 300 pounds of carbon dioxide a year? If all Americans switched to CFLs, we would save more than 90 billion pounds of carbon dioxide. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Muni Radio in San Francisco.
That was the main theme of a PBS series called From the Earth to the Moon, a very inspiring piece of music. The story of Betty and Barney Hill is probably the best-known case of an encounter with an alien ship and its occupants, and it is the first abduction case of the 20th century to penetrate the public consciousness. In September of 1961, Betty and Barney were returning home from a vacation in Canada. Barney had been diagnosed with an ulcer, and it was suggested that a road trip would help relieve the stress that was thought to be the cause of his stomach problems. It was a little past 10 in the evening as they were driving along U.S. Route No. 3 through a heavily wooded area in central New Hampshire when they saw what seemed to be a bright star or planet. It was Barney who first noticed it. After he pointed it out to Betty, they both kept a close watch on the light in the sky as best they could. It was a clear night, illuminated by a crescent moon, but the trees of the forest would periodically obstruct their view. Barney believed that it was an airplane, but Betty wasn't so sure. As they continued to watch, the object began to move erratically. Barney stopped the car. He got out to get a better look with his binoculars. He saw a flat-looking object with multicolored lights and rows of windows. And when it moved to within 100 feet, he could see people through those windows looking back at him. He became frightened and ran back to the car. But as they resumed their ride home, Betty and Barney were unable to spot the strange object anymore. They did hear a strange beeping sound, however, and shortly thereafter they heard it again. It was then that they noticed they were about 35 miles down the road from where they had been just a couple of minutes earlier. They didn't talk much as they drove home to Portsmouth and went to bed. When they got up the next afternoon, Betty called her sister Janet and told her what had happened. Janet suggested that she call the Air Force Base nearby and report what she had seen. Although Barney was against making the call, preferring instead to put the whole thing out of his mind, Betty phoned and reported the incident to Major Paul W. Henderson at Pease Air Force Base. He told her that the UFO had also been tracked on their radar. A few weeks later, the hills were visited by three men who said that they had heard of their sighting. Two of the men said that they were writers, and the third identified himself as Major James McDonald, a retired Air Force intelligence officer. After reviewing the facts of their story, the three men discovered that Betty and Barney had a good 2 hours that were unaccounted for during their ride home after the encounter with the strange object. Major McDonald then suggested that regressive hypnotherapy might help account for the missing time. Incidentally, the two men who accompanied the major have never been identified, nor have they come forward to include their names in the public record of this historic case of UFO abduction. Soon thereafter, Betty began having recurring nightmares of Barney and her being taken aboard a flying saucer. Barney's ulcer was also getting worse. After some discussion, they decided to follow Major McDonald's suggestion and try hypnosis as a way to dislodge their memories of those 2 missing hours. After doing some research on the psychiatrists in the area, the Hills decided on a well-known Boston psychiatrist and neurologist, Dr. Benjamin Simon. Dr. Simon's preliminary diagnosis was anxiety syndrome, related to an unknown event of the night of September 19, 1961. But to help relieve his patients of that anxiety, he had to first find out what that event was. Dr. Simon began hypnotherapy sessions with Barney first, and then afterwards repeated the same treatment with Betty. It was a slow process that lasted 6 months. At the end of it, Dr. Simon's expert opinion was that the Hills had been taken aboard by an unknown flying craft on the night in question. Anyone who's interested in these sessions can read their edited transcripts in an excellent book on the Hill abduction case, The Interrupted Journey, by John G. Fuller, an award-winning investigative author. Their story was also the subject of a 2-part article in Look magazine and a 1976 made-for-TV movie titled The UFO Incident, starring Estelle Parsons as Betty and James Earl Jones as Barney. In repeated hypnotherapy sessions, the Hills remembered independently of each other the following details of the encounter. Their car had been stalled soon after they left the area where Barney had stopped to get a better look. The alien craft then landed on the road in front of them, blocking their way. They were taken aboard, placed in separate rooms, and given medical examinations. Later, they were released after being given a post-hypnotic suggestion to forget the encounter. The beings that Betty and Barney encountered were described as, quote, ball-headed alien beings, about 5 feet tall, with grayish skin, pear-shaped heads, and slanting cat-like eyes, end quote. As part of their examination, samples of skin, hair, and fingernails were taken. Betty had a long needle inserted into her navel and was told that it was a pregnancy test. In the other room, Barney had been made to give a semen sample. Betty also said that she was given a kind of book as a remembrance of their visit, but that they later thought better of it and took it back. At one point, the aliens appeared surprised to discover that Barney's teeth could be removed. He wore dentures. Betty asked the one who appeared to be in charge, their captain, where they were from, and in reply she was shown a holographic projection of a star map with lines, some thick, others thin, connecting the stars. These, Betty was told, represented trade routes. After the hills were taken back to their car, the last thing they remembered was an orange glow disappearing into the night sky. The Hills tried to keep their story out of the media, but unfortunately an inaccurate version of it leaked to the press. At that point, Betty and Barney decided to come forward and describe the real events of their case. Dr. Simon was under pressure to release whatever information the Hills would authorize about their case. This was considered prudent to stop any speculation that the absence of a statement by him would imply that he thought negatively about their story. Simon had in fact concluded that the Hills were being completely truthful. He said that there were a couple of conclusions that could be reached, quote, "The experience actually happened, or some perspective and illusionary misinterpretation occurred in relationship to some real event," end quote. As mentioned earlier, when Betty was aboard the craft, she was shown a star map by the leader that was three-dimensional, with different-sized dots representing stars and lines between them representing trade routes. While under hypnosis, she drew a copy of what she had seen. Betty was standing about 3 feet away from it when she was shown the map. She said there were many other stars on the map, but that she only was able to specifically recall under hypnosis the prominent ones connected by lines and a small distinctive triangle off to the left. The fact that astronomers at the time couldn't find any constellation that fit her drawing cast considerable doubt on the whole story of their abduction. Betty drew her map in 1963. However, in the next few years, with newer, more powerful telescopes, many new stars were added to the stellar catalogs, including three that appeared on Betty's map. Armed with this new information, in 1969, astronomers at Ohio State University entered the data into their computer and put the stars in their exact position. Out beyond the double star system of Zeta Reticuli 1 and Zeta Reticuli 2, about 220 trillion miles, or 37 light-years, from Earth. They then rendered a picture from their perspective of looking toward our sun. The computer duplicated Betty's star map with virtually no variation. The case of Betty and Barney Hill represent the best documented report of a UFO abduction, with the possible exception of Betty Andreasen. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll learn about the Betty Andreasen affair.
Meals on Wheels is dedicated to fostering independent living for San Francisco seniors by providing hot, nutritious meals delivered to their homes. They're committed to fostering independent living for as long as possible. For more information, please call Meals on Wheels at 415-920-1111. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio in San Francisco.
Save our democracy. We must reverse Citizens United, restore our democracy, and save the Republic. Join the fight for free and fair elections in America. Wolf Pack is the pack to end all packs, and they're working for a constitutional amendment to get money and legalized bribery out of politics, but they need your help. Become a member, volunteer your time, and sign their petition at wolf-pack.com.
The National Lawyers Guild is dedicated to the need for basic change in the structure of our political and economic systems. They seek to unite lawyers, law students, legal workers, and jailhouse lawyers of America to function as an effective political and social force in the service of the people, to the end that human rights shall be regarded as more sacred than mere property interests. For more information about your legal rights, how to obtain legal assistance, or to donate, please contact the National Lawyers Guild at nlgsg.org. That's nlgsg.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Was Spaceman by Harry Nilsson. When I was a young boy, I told my grandmother that I was going to the moon. She asked me how I was going to do that. I told her I was going to invent the rocket fuel that would get us there, and I wouldn't give it to the government unless they let me go too. Needless to say, things didn't turn out as I had expected. In the town of South Ashburn, Massachusetts, on the night of January 25, 1967, one of the most respected cases of UFO abduction began to unfold. Betty Andreasen was cleaning up in the kitchen while her seven children and her mother and father were in the living room. Shortly after 6:30 in the evening, the lights in the house blinked, and immediately thereafter a pulsating reddish light began to stream through the kitchen window. The sudden darkness in the house set the kids' nerves on edge, and Betty ran to comfort them, while her father went into the kitchen to peer out the window, hoping to see the source of the unusual light. To his utter amazement, he observed five odd-looking beings moving toward the house in a hopping motion. He then saw them walk right through the back door. The entire family was suddenly put into a state of suspended animation. One of the aliens went to Betty's father, while the other one, who seemed to be the leader, began to communicate with Betty telepathically. He was about 5 feet tall. The other four appeared to be about a foot shorter. All of the beings had a pear-shaped head, wide, cat-like wraparound eyes, and small ears and noses. Their mouths were only slits that never moved. They communicated instead with their minds. The aliens wore a type of overhaul, blue in color with a wide belt. There was also a logo of a bird on their sleeves. Their hands had only 3 fingers, and they wore boots. They didn't move as humans do, but instead floated above the floor. Betty would later relate that although she was frightened, she felt calm and even had a feeling of friendship toward the beings. The aliens were holding Betty's family in a frozen state of paralysis, but when Betty showed concern for them, the aliens temporarily released her 11-year-old daughter, Becky, to assure her that no one was being harmed. Betty was taken by 4 of the aliens outside to a waiting craft in the backyard, while one of them stayed behind to watch over her family. The craft was the typical saucer shape and estimated to be about 20 feet in diameter. Betty believed that after she was taken aboard, it joined a larger mothership where she underwent a physical examination. After this, she was given a kind of religious experience with a being they called the One. More on that in a minute. After approximately 4 hours, she was returned home by 2 of the beings. The beings then helped the family, who were still under some type of mind control, get into bed, and then they left. Betty would later say that the aliens had hypnotized her so that she wouldn't recall most of the experience until a predetermined time. She was only able to remember the beginning of her experience, the power outage, the red light through the kitchen window, and the aliens entering the house. Betty, a devout Christian, interpreted the beings as religious or angelic in nature. The subject of UFOs was largely unknown to her. She only had a 10th grade education, and her basic interests were limited to family, church, and community-related activities. Not until much later did she think of her experience as a possible UFO encounter. 8 years later, Betty answered an ad from Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was soliciting abduction experiences from the general public. Her letter was dismissed at the time because of its unusual details, and it wouldn't be until January of 1977 that her story would be fully investigated. The investigative team assigned to the Andreasen case included an odd assortment of specialists. In addition to a UFO investigator, there was a solar physicist, an electronics engineer, an aerospace engineer, a telecommunications specialist, and the 12-month investigation that followed also included the services of a hypnotist and a medical doctor trained in psychiatry. Betty was made the subject of a character reference check, 2 lie detector tests, a psychiatric review, and 14 sessions of regressive hypnosis. The results were published in a 528-page report, which stated that Betty and her family were sane individuals who sincerely believed all of the details given in their statements. Under hypnosis, Betty revealed that her experiences with alien beings started in early childhood. I'm going to quote now from the published transcript of a hypnotic regression that Betty underwent, which took her back to one of her first abduction experiences at the age of 13, when she first met the One. Betty, "We're coming up to this wall of glass, and it's big, 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 big door. It's made of glass. Does it have hinges? No. It is so big, and there is, I can't explain it, the door is after door after door after door. He, the alien who is leading her, he is stopping there and telling me to stop. I'm just stopping there. He says, 'Now you shall enter the door to see the One.' And he says, 'Fear not.' Then Betty appears to undergo an out-of-body experience. I'm standing there, and I'm coming out of myself. There's two of me. There's two of me there. Are you looking at yourself? Uh-huh. Okay, do you see the one yet? The one? No. Okay, go on. I'm coming up to the door, and the little person says, "Now you shall enter the great door and see the glory of the one." And I'm standing face to face with that door. Betty describes its appearance and her out-of-body experience. It is big, but it is strange. It is like deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's bright. It's really bright, and I have to stand before the door. But before that, I came out of myself. I was just standing over there, and I was standing over here. There were two of me, but the one over there was stiff. Have you tried to talk to yourself? It won't work because I'm over here and that one is over there. She looks exactly like you. Is she making any motions to show you that she's alive, like breathing or moving her arms? No. Would you say that she looks like a wax museum piece or something? No, it looks just like me. All right, go on. I was told to come forward. I went in the door, and it's very bright. I can't take you any further. Why? Because. What do you mean, because? I can't take you past this door. Several times the hypnotist tried in different ways to get Betty to tell him what was beyond the door. Every attempt failed. Sometime, maybe, if you change your mind, would you tell me? I can't change my mind. It's set. What would happen to you if you did tell me? I can't tell you. I'm sorry. Okay. Let's proceed to the first thing you can tell me. Fair enough? Oh! Betty's face glowed with joy. What's happening now? I'm coming out of that door, and it was wonderful. Did the one say something exciting? I can't tell you. I'm sorry. Would you say that the one was God? To which Betty replied, Do you really know what God is? I don't know. I was hoping that you had seen him, and therefore you could tell me. I can't tell you about that. I want to interrupt here to say that it has been my experience that the Greys will use the symbols and myths of a person's religion to convey spiritual concepts. It doesn't matter what their religion is. It doesn't even have to be monotheistic in nature. Take myself, for example. I'm a pagan. I honor many gods and goddesses. During one of my hypnotherapy sessions, I relived a meeting I had with the Egyptian god Horus. He was dressed in a business suit and seated behind a large executive-type desk. Now back to Betty Andreasen and her encounter with the One. During the next session, the hypnotist was determined to find out what lay behind the great door, and again he brought Betty back in time to where she was standing before it. Where are you? I'm before this huge, great big door. It's glass, layers and layers of glass. What are you standing on? Glass. Let me ask you now. You're going to see the one now, right? Yeah. Why are you going to see the one? Because it's time. They said it's time for me to go home to see the one. All right. In other words, does this imply that the one is someone that you have seen before? I don't remember. Okay. Do you know why it is time to see the one? Why haven't you asked questions? They haven't been there very often. These little people haven't been there very often for me to ask. Yeah, but they are asking you to do a lot of things, shall we say. I know, but I'm in their place. I can't do anything. Okay. In a minute, you're going to see the one, right? We don't want to waste the experience. We want to get the most out of it. So when you see the one, I want you to ask yourself, what am I getting out of this? Why am I here? And what will this mean to me later on in my life? It's like any big experience a person is allowed to have, okay? I want you to progress to where the door is open, and you are seeing the one. Oh! At that very moment, an indescribable smile came across Betty's face. The only adjective that the investigators could think of was rapturous. Her expression of pure joy continued as the hypnotist resumed his questioning. You seem happy. Why are you so happy?
It's just, I can't tell you about that.
All right, I know you can't tell me, but I want you to do a few things. I want you to ask yourself why you're being shown what you're being shown. In other words, you weren't given this trip just for a free ride, so to speak. They want you to see what you're seeing. Does that make sense?
Yes. All right, now that you're there, ask yourself, what am I getting out of this? Why am I here? What am I supposed to think about after I leave here? It matters not what I get from it. What do you mean? The words cannot explain it. It's wonderful. It's for everybody. I just can't tell you this. You can't. Okay. Why can't you? For one thing, it's too overwhelming, and it is indescribable. I just can't tell you. Besides, it's just impossible for me to tell you. All right. Are you capable, when looking around you, to tell yourself? I see it. Right. That which you can see, you have a grasp of, even if you don't understand it. I understand it. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry. I wish I could share it with you. Were you told not to share it with me? It is like even if I was able to speak it, I wouldn't be able to speak it. I can't. I'm sorry. Were you specifically told not to speak it? Partly, yeah. How was it expressed to you? I can't tell you those things. I'm sorry. All right. Can we let the beans speak through you? Suppose you just relax, and I'll put my hand on your shoulder, and with each number you will go deeper and deeper. When I reach 3, you will just relax and allow the beans to speak through you. 1, 2, 3. Betty begins to speak in a strange tongue. Okay, Betty, can you explain to me, so that I can understand, what you just said? Betty begins crying. Father loves the world so very much. Yes, and so many reject him. Uh-huh, okay. You said a lot of words. Can you explain more of what you said? They will be felt by those who believe and have faith. They will feel the love radiating from them. Okay. Where are you now? I'm where there is light. And what do you see? I cannot tell you this. Okay, that's all right. Let me ask you. Do you feel love, the same love, or any different degree of love now than you did before? It's a greater love. Okay. When will I understand all the words that the being has said through you? When you allow the spirit to come upon you and you are filled with that love. Do you understand the words that you have said? I understand them, but they will not come forth. Okay, I'm trying to understand. I'm not trying to ask you to divulge anything, all right? You understand them, but you can't express them? They're in my heart. More like a feeling than a concept. They're in my heart, in my mind, in my body. Okay, could you explain this to your children? What children? During this hypnotic session, Betty was regressed to a childhood experience that occurred at the age of 13, when she had no children. If you have children someday. The words that you spoke, while they had a message of love in them, did they also have a warning? Yes, those that do not love have nothing. Love is the answer. Again, the hypnotist failed to elicit the information that he wanted regarding what Betty had experienced behind the great door. He tried one more time. Okay, you've seen the one. Do you feel different about anything now than you did before? Everything is so wonderful. Is there anybody that you don't like? No. There are some people, shall we say, that aren't as nice as other people, right? No, everybody is nice. They are just growing, that's all. If one doesn't understand another one, they are just growing, that's all. Okay, just relax. You've been to see the one, and now everything's a little nicer, right? I understand that everything is one. What do you mean? Everything fits together. Everything is one. It's beautiful, no matter what it is. In a later series of hypnotherapy sessions, Betty revealed another religious experience, this time with an icon of paganism, the phoenix. According to Betty, the aliens took her to a special room. In that room, she saw a huge bird about 15 feet tall. The bird resembled an eagle, but it had a longer neck. It was, in fact, an image of the phoenix, and it looked to be alive. As she stood and watched it, the phoenix began to undergo a transformation. Betty felt an intense heat so powerful that she cried out in pain during her hypnotic session while recounting the incident. The room suddenly cooled, and where the great bird had stood, there was now a small fire. The fire died down to a pile of gray ash with a few red embers. As the pile continued to cool, Betty saw something in the ashes. Now it looks like a worm. A big fat worm. It just looks like a big fat worm. A big gray worm just lying there.
What Betty had witnessed, and what was clearly staged for her benefit, was a reenactment of the legend of the phoenix. According to the story, the phoenix bird is the only one of its kind. Every 500 years, according to the Greek version of the myth, the time interval will differ with different cultures telling the story, the phoenix would build a funeral pyre made of spices, upon which he would then sit. The rays of the sun would ignite the spices, and the phoenix would be consumed in the fire. In the smoldering ashes, however, the phoenix would be reborn as a worm. The word phoenix is Greek in origin, but the legend was taken from the earlier Egyptian myth of the Bennu bird, which exhibits many of the same characteristics as the Greek phoenix. The death and rebirth of the Bennu bird was associated with the death and resurrection of the Egyptian god Osiris, itself said by many biblical researchers to be the basis for the story of the resurrection of Jesus. Clearly, each of these symbols, the phoenix, the Bennu bird, Osiris, and Jesus as a resurrected Christ, have similar religious meaning, the basis of which is death and rebirth. In other words, reincarnation. In my book, Abducted by Aliens, I explain how I came to learn that the Greys originate beyond death's great door, as UFO researcher Raymond Fowler put it, and that they are the guardians of the mechanism of reincarnation. For anyone interested, my book is available as a free PDF download at abductedbyaliens.org. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we'll learn about a very credible encounter that two fishermen in Mississippi had in 1973 with a species of alien not described before that had lobster-like claws for hands.
The Mosaic Project, based in Oakland, aspires towards a peaceful future by reaching out to children in their formative years. The Principal Program is a unique outdoor school which unites 4th and 5th graders with diverse backgrounds, providing them with the skills required to thrive in an increasingly diverse society, and empowers them to strive for peace. Mosaic creates a microcosm of the diverse, inclusive, just world we want to see, and shows the young students that peace is possible. They are always looking for youth leaders aged 15 to 21 to be mentors for younger students. Please visit mosaicproject.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio in the Bay Area.
Fire! The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education is dedicated to defending individual rights in higher education. Founded in 1999, this nonprofit group focuses on civil liberties in academia and the United States. Its goal is to defend and sustain individual rights at America's colleges and universities, including the right to freedom of speech, legal equality, due process, religious liberty, and sanctity of conscience, the essential qualities of individual liberty and dignity. You can find out more or support this group at thefire.org. This public service announcement has been brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Do you have a great idea for a product or service but don't know where to start? Are you looking to expand your current business? Women's Initiative of San Francisco began its business management training program for low-income, high-potential women in 1988. To attend a free orientation on how you can achieve your dream of starting your own business, or for more information, please contact 415-641-3460 or visit womensinitiative.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Think you're the only one. Sage Mom. My Space Sage Mom.
That was Space Age Mom by Damian Hurado. I apologize. I know that was offensive to many UFO experiencers, but I included that little number for any skeptics out there who may be listening. And what the hell, you have to be able to laugh at yourself once in a while. 42-year-old Charles Hickson and 19-year-old Kevin Parker worked together in a shipyard in Mississippi. They decided on the night of October 11, 1973, to go fishing after work. They stood on a pier on the west bank of the Pascagoula River, baited their lines, and was waiting for the fish to bite, when suddenly they heard a whirling, whizzing sound and saw an oval-shaped object with flashing blue lights appear near them. They said that later it looked like some 8 feet across and 8 or more feet in height, and that the craft seemed to levitate about 2 feet off the ground. The door opened and three aliens emerged. They seized the two men and floated or levitated them into the craft. Both of them reported being paralyzed and numb. Parker said that he fainted because he was so scared. They described the terrifying creatures as being roughly humanoid in shape, standing about 5 feet tall. Their skin was pale in color and wrinkled, and they had no eyes that the men could discern, and only a slit for a mouth. The heads also appeared connected directly to their shoulders without any neck. There were three carrot-like appendages, one where the nose would be and the other two where the ears would be, if they had any. The beings had lobster-like claws at the end of their arms, and they seemed to have only one leg, ending in elephant-like feet. Hickson later described the lower bodies as looking as if their legs were fused together. Hickson also reported that the creatures moved in mechanical, robotic-like ways. On the ship, Hickson said that he was somehow levitated a few feet above the floor and was examined by what looked like a large football-shaped mechanical eye about 6 to 10 inches across that appeared to scan his body. Parker reported that he could not recall what had happened to him inside the craft, although later, during sessions of hypnotic regression, he offered some hazy details. After about 20 minutes, the men were released and the creatures levitated them back to their original spot on the fishing pier. In an interview some 20 years after the initial incident, Parker confessed to lying about fainting at the sight of the creatures. He claimed that he was, in fact, conscious when the creatures took him aboard the craft. He said that he was laid down on a sloping table and examined by a petite being, evidently female. Although he was paralyzed, he was able to observe the being inject a needle into the base of the underside of his penis. The being later communicated with him telepathically, suggesting that he had been taken for a reason. Parker felt a sense of imminent harm during the encounter, but nonetheless, he was led back outside the craft and deposited unharmed onto the pier. He also said that 19 years later, he came in contact with the same craft again, but that this time he voluntarily walked aboard and met with the same female being that had examined him in 1973. He said that he had had a conversation with the being in English in which she communicated to him a religious message. She informed him that they shared the same God and that her species wanted to live on Earth but could not due to humanity's tendency toward war and destruction. Both men say that they were terrified by what had happened. They say that they sat in the car for about 45 minutes afterwards trying to calm themselves down. After some discussion, they tried to report their story to the officials at Keesler Air Force Base, but personnel there told them that the Air Force had nothing more to do with UFO reports, Project Blue Book having been discontinued about 4 years earlier. It was suggested that the men notify police. At about 10:30 that night, Hickson and Parker arrived at the Jackson County Sheriff's Office. They brought with them the catfish they had caught while fishing, it being the only proof they had to back up their story. Sheriff Fred Diamond thought that the men seemed sincere and genuinely frightened, and he thought that Parker was especially disturbed. Diamond, however, harbored some doubt about their fantastic story, so, after repeated questioning, Diamond left the two men alone in a room that was, unknown to both of them, rigged with a hidden microphone. As researcher Jeremy Clark wrote, quote, Sheriff Diamond assumed that if they were lying, the fact would become immediately apparent when the two spoke privately. Instead, they continued to talk as if terribly disturbed. End quote. The tape recording of their conversation has gained wide circulation in the UFO community. Let me quote from the transcript. Calvin, I got to get home and get to bed, or get some nerve pills, or see the doctor or something. I can't stand it. I'm about to go half crazy. I tell you, when we're through, I'm going to get something to settle you down so you get some damn sleep. I can't sleep yet. Like it is, I'm just damn near crazy. When they brought me out of that thing, God damn it, I'd like to never in hell got you straightened out. My damn arms, my arms. I remember they just froze up and I couldn't move. It was just like I stepped on a damn rattlesnake. They didn't do me that way. Now both men were talking as if to themselves. I passed out. I never passed out my whole life. I never seen nothing like that before in my life. You can't make people believe. I don't want to keep sitting here. I want to see a doctor. They better wake up and start believing. They better start believing. You see how that damn door opened right up? I don't know how it opened, son. I don't know. It just laid up just like that. And those son of bitches, just like that, they came out. I know. You can't believe it. You can't make people believe it. I paralyzed right then. I couldn't move. They won't believe it. They're going to believe it one of these days. Might be too late. I knew all along there were people from other worlds up there. I knew all along. I never thought it would happen to me. You know yourself, I don't drink. I know that, son. When I get home to the house, I'm going to get a drink to make me sleep. Look, what are we sitting here for? I got to go tell Blanche. What are we waiting for? I got to go to the house. I'm getting sick. I got to get out of here. Then Charlie got up and left the room, leaving Calvin alone. It's hard to believe. Oh, God, it's awful. I know there's a God up there. Hickson and Parker returned to work the next day. They didn't initially discuss their UFO encounter, but co-workers noticed that Parker seemed very anxious and preoccupied. Within hours, Sheriff Diamond telephoned the men at work to say that news reporters were all over him, seeking more information about the UFO story. Hickson accused Diamond of breaking his pledge of confidentiality, but Diamond insisted that he had not done so and that the case was too sensational to keep quiet. The work foreman overheard Hickson's side of the conversation and asked what was happening. Hickson related the story of their encounter to the foreman and then to shipyard owner Johnny Walker, who then suggested that Hickson and Parker contact Joe Kalingo, a prominent local attorney who was Walker's brother-in-law and also represented the shipyard. Kalingo drew up a contract to represent Hickson and Parker, but nothing came of it, and Hickson would later have nothing to do with Kalingo, accusing the attorney of base financial motivations. Kalingo said Hickson just wanted to make a buck. Within days, Pascagoula was the center of an international news story with reporters swarming all over town. James Harder, a UC Berkeley engineering professor, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, an astronomer formerly with Project Blue Book, both arrived on the scene and interviewed Parker and Hickson. Harder tried to hypnotize the men, but they were too anxious and distracted at the time for the procedure to work, with Parker especially so. Hynek withheld judgment on the case, but commented that, in his opinion, Hickson and Parker were honest men who seemed genuinely distressed about what had occurred. Parker eventually had an emotional breakdown and was hospitalized. In an interview several years later, Hickson speculated that Parker fared worse afterwards because he had never previously experienced a profoundly frightening ordeal. While Hickson described the encounter as the most terrifying event of his life, he also noted that he had seen combat in the Korean War, and he had thus had some familiarity with the terrifying experience. The younger Parker, on the other hand, had never suffered a terrifying event, let alone a bizarre confrontation with something that wasn't supposed to even exist. In 2011, Charles Hickson died at the age of 80. Despite years of ridicule, he maintained to the end that his story of alien abduction was true. Both Parker and Hickson had volunteered to take a polygraph test to prove their stories. In the end, only Hickson did so, and the examiner determined that he was being truthful about his UFO abduction. Parker has avoided most public attention since the event. Hixon appeared on The Dick Cavett Show in January of 1974 and occasionally spoke at UFO conferences. He also co-authored a book about the event with William Mendes entitled UFO Contact at Pascagoula, published in 1983 and reprinted in 1987. As a final note on this case, in 2001, retired Navy Chief Petty Officer Mike Cataldo revealed that he observed an unusual craft at dusk on the same day that Hixon and Parker had their encounter. While traveling with his crewmates, Ted Peralta and Mac Hanna, on U.S. Route 90 from Pascagoula to Ocean Springs, an object, quote, like a large tambourine with small flashing lights, end quote, approached from the northwest and crossed the freeway before hovering over the tree line and disappearing. As Mr. Cataldo approached his home in St. Andrews, the craft made a second appearance at a lower altitude. We're going to take one more break so you can hear this important message.
I'm looking for this really cool podcast station.
There are a lot of really cool podcast stations. You're going to have to be a little bit more specific.
Well, I'm not sure what it's called anymore. I went through a lot of changes. First, it was Pirates.
Pirates?
And then there's a bunch of initials, PC something. I really didn't get it.
No, I don't see anything under Pirates or confusing initials. Could you tell me something more about the station?
Well, I had an amazing following.
Like a cult?
No, not like a cult, more like a collective.
Collective?
Whatever, bottom line, people listened to it, was good.
What made the station so good?
Well, for starters, there was 30 unique radio shows.
That sounds like a lot.
Because it is. They had local and world news programs, open mic poetry slams, live bands, comedy shows, local world music shows, Spanish language, Greek language, community organized, centered shows, even a show about 420.
Weed? There was a show about weed on this station?
Yeah. And get this, half their DJs are women.
I like that. What kind of music did they play?
Everything, house, techno, hip-hop, garage, soul, world, new, old, uptown, downtown, underground, vinyl. It was really cool.
Well, I looked all through the database, and I could only find one podcast station that fits that very description.
Really? You found my station. Are there pirates or animals? A bunch of initials I won't remember. What the hell's the name of the station?
Mutiny Radio, it says here. Mutiny Radio.
Mutiny Radio? Mutiny Radio?
Yeah, Mutiny Radio.
Well, that's a good name.
You're listening to Mutiny Radio. Same great station, new great name.
This is Akbar, the intergalactic Asiatic starfighter. Creative rhyme writer, I meditate like a spider. And I'm with my man Reese Knapp, we teach math. Raptivist, black activist. Check the hi-fi, sci-fi. About to go down in your town. One, two. One, two. Yo, yo. I was walking down the street late one night when I looked up in the sky cause I spotted a light. I said to myself it couldn't be the moon, and it wasn't a plane or a weather balloon, but whatever it was ready to land, so I didn't try to play no Superman. I began to walk, then I started to run, so I could drop the dime, dial 911. I said, yo, officer, I think that you should know that I just spotted a UFO. He said we can't go on just by what you say, cause we get calls like this every day. In order for us to write out a report, you must have evidence of some sort. Well, I didn't even get a chance to interrupt, cause the next thing I knew, the pig hung up. I checked my watch, it was 3:45. Then I ran to the house, opened up the door, jumped in the bed and took a Tylenol, and tried to forget the whole thing I saw. But it was what it was.
What was it, cuz?
But it was what it was.
What was it, cuz?
But it was what it was.
What was it, cuz?
A UFO flying low. I couldn't budge. Look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. Feels like I'm stuck. I must have struck a nerve in my brain. Yo, I saw the mothership.
Visions of the crystal city made a rubber flip. It was the mothership. Yo, I saw the mothership. Visions of the crystal city made a rubber flip. I was smack dab in the middle of a wonderful dream when I was suddenly awoken by a frightening scream. My first reaction was to grab my heat, pull down the covers, threw back the sheets, looked over to the window, sprang to my feet. Outside, I saw mad people on the street in a state of shock. Somebody called the cops to quiet the riot, but now they pulling out blocks, shutting down blocks, busting shots in the sky. But why even try to defy the Most High? It was a divine sign, encounter of the third kind. Let my words shine till the planets realign. Tell the angels to hold the four winds before the world ends when the Lamb descends. Introducing them to the New Jerusalem to settle the pain and end the devil's reign. The mothership came. I saw the mothership. You might think I'm on the brink of some other sh, but it was what it was. But it was what it was. But it was what it was. Actually, my angelic brothers was coming back for me. Yo, I saw the mothership. Visions of the crystal city made a rubber flip. It was the mothership. Yo, I saw the mothership. Visions of the crystal city made this rubber flip. It was the mothership. Yo, I saw the mothership. Visions of the crystal city made a rubber flip. It was the mothership. Yo, I saw the mothership. Visions of the crystal city made this rubber flip. Flip.
That was my vain attempt to appear relevant to the younger part of the audience. Mothership by rapper Akbar. Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. We also have a 40-seat performance space available for rent, as well as an art gallery that we offer free to local artists. So, if you're a performer looking for a really cheap place to put on a show, or if you're an artist looking for free space to display your talents, give our station director, Pam Benjamin, a call at 415-550-0511. That's area code 415-550-0511. This is the third episode of Close Encounters, and I've tried with these first offerings to present to my listeners a basic introduction to the modern UFO era. In the first podcast, we learned how it began with Kenneth Arnold's sighting of 9 flying saucers over Mount Rainier. We also learned that in 1952, a fleet of UFOs buzzed Washington, D.C. and the White House, and how the Air Force responded, first publicly with explanations involving temperature inversions and weather balloons, and then privately with a serious investigation of UFOs, which concluded that 22% of all UFO sightings were real unknowns. In my second podcast, I presented the details of what is perhaps the best researched case of a UFO crash and retrieval of wreckage, the famous Roswell incident. And tonight I've showcased 3 well-researched cases of alien abduction. All of this has been in preparation of what will be the main focus of this show. In my next podcast, we'll begin to delve deeper into the subject of alien abduction. This is, in fact, my area of expertise. I've been involved in that aspect of the UFO phenomena for over 20 years now, and I feel that I'm as well-versed on the subject as any researcher. These podcasts have taken more time to produce than I had anticipated, so I won't be posting a weekly schedule anymore. At my age, 67, I can't sustain that pace, and I need my afternoon nap. Instead, I hope to post a new show every 2 to 3 weeks. This material never becomes outdated, like a political podcast, for example, so I hope that you'll check back occasionally to see what I've posted on the subject of UFOs and alien abduction. Until next time, know that the truth is out there, but that the truth is always Rashomon.
Trenton off full on position there at Camp Park. Frankie, we copy. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out. Mayflower, we copy there at Camp 4, Camp 4, 104 out.